KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday. Steve Scheer is taking a sabbatical for the next 5 months. I'll be in for him. Coming up on the show later today, we're going to talk with jazz legend Chick Corea. We talked with him at Jazz Alley. He's playing with a new band he put together. Gluten-free girl Shauna James Ahern's going to be in. She's got a new book out. And later in the show, our regular Friday panel of journalists talks over the week's news. Earlier this year, Seattleites were shocked when a drunk driver plowed into a Wedgwood family out for a walk with their brand new baby. Two people were killed, the grandparents. The mother and baby were critically injured. Citizens and some lawmakers upped their call to increase penalties for repeat drunk drivers after that incident. Even though the legislature adjourned last weekend, lawmakers will take up drunk driver bills when they reconvene in special session on May 13th. KUOW's Patricia Murphy has been looking into both the bills and how we currently handle DUI offenders and offenses. Joins me in the studio. You've got a series of stories that have been running this week.
Yes, thanks, Marcy.
When we talk about DUI offenders, how many people are we talking about?
There are 40,000 people, according to the State Patrol, who are arrested for suspicion of driving under the influence every year in the state.
And these are new offenses, repeat offenses?
These are, in a lot of cases, first offenses, but we do have a segment that is a problematic second and third, and as we know, fourth and fifth offenders.
Do they handle them differently if they're first offenses?
Well, there are one of the things that I found in reporting this story is that judges have a lot of latitude with what they can do with first-time offenders. They have a lot of things that they can consider. So it's hard to pin down, you know, the things that a first-time offender will receive in terms of punishment, except for the things that can't be changed, the ignition interlock system that they're supposed to put on their cars, the fact that it's going to cost about $21,000 if you don't qualify for a public defender.
Really? That's to bring your lawyer to court?
That's everything, you know, from the towing costs to get your car out of the impound. Depending on who you hire, that could be between $10,000 and $20,000. And the ignition interlock, all that stuff comes with fees. So it's a very, very expensive mistake for a first-time offender.
Most people do or don't qualify for a public defender.
Most people do not qualify for public defender. The poverty guidelines are so low that a family of three would have to make under $2,000 a month, which when you think about what we consider to be the working poor is a huge segment of the population that doesn't qualify for financial assistance.
So you're talking about ignition locks and towing and these $20,000 of expenses. And I know some of that, if you have a fine, obviously that goes to the government. Where does the rest of this money go?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. It goes back into the programs, I think, because a lot of these things, ignition interlocks and the monitoring anklets that, that some offenders have to wear, those are all offender-funded programs. So they probably go right back into the costs of implementing those programs.
What about things like the towing services? I know they've changed a lot of these things, and lawmakers are looking at when they're talking about increasing penalties. Are they talking about making everybody have these devices? Are they talking about everybody having the ankle devices? What are they talking about specifically?
Well, at this point, you are required to have an ignition interlock. And this is one of the things that we found out. If you get a DUI and you're convicted, you need to have this thing on your car. There are 43,000 people right now in the Department of Licensing database that are supposed to have this device on their car.
You said supposed to have this device on their car.
26,000 actually have it installed. So there's about 17,000 people, you know, that legally are not able to drive. We just don't know if they're driving.
Well, as I understand it, the drunk driver who was charged in the case in Wedgwood earlier this year theoretically was supposed to have this device. He was a numerous time repeat offender. He did not.
He did not. And that's the thing. That's why we say it's an imperfect system, because it only works if people do what they're supposed to do. And there is a, you know, according to the DOL, there's 53,000 people who are currently suspended for not doing what they're supposed to do with these interlocks. It's our inability really to determine whether or not they're actually driving.
Are these number of people who have the DUI offenses, do we know where they are? Are they throughout the state? Are they
here? We have a handy map.
A map?
On our website.
Okay.
Where you can put in your zip code. It shows DUI ignition interlock compliance throughout the state. And it's kind of fascinating to look at. You know, there are some areas where there is very high compliance, and there are some smaller outlying areas where you have some pretty high non-compliance rates. And again, we don't know if these people are driving. We just know that they don't have this device installed on their car.
I'm assuming that when the legislature does reconvene on the 13th, that they're looking at upping or stiffening some of these penalties or requirements?
Yes. They're looking at adding jail time for repeat offenders. There's an interesting part of that bill that's being considered, which would allow people to opt out of jail time in favor of treatment. And treatment is a part of the system that is important to people who want to address their addiction, right? Mm-hmm. There are a number of people who will never want to address their addiction, and that's a problem.
So treatment is not mandated?
Well, you have to get an alcohol assessment when you get convicted of a DUI.
What is
or,
that?
Or not convicted. When you're arrested for a DUI, you have to go to a counselor and get your use assessed. And one of the things we found is that if I get convicted or get a DUI, I'm going to go to a counselor and I might not like what that counselor has to say about my alcohol use. So I say, thanks very much. I pay them the $100 and I go someplace else. And maybe I answer those questions differently. And maybe I look less like an alcoholic and more like, somebody who made a mistake.
Wow.
And that is a significant problem when I spoke with treatment counselors that people understand, especially determined alcoholics or people who are unwilling to address their disease, that they learn how to game the system very, very quickly. And what this counselor told me that was really interesting in terms of people like Mark Mullen, who are now, you know, on trial for...
And that's the offender in the Wedgwood case.
Yeah. This guy, he said, people should have known. People knew that this guy, you know, had a significant problem and was spiraling. And there's really very little triangulation between treatment providers and the courts. And those are the guys who are boots on the ground who know these people the best.
Well, is there any way that legally that triangulation can be mandated? Or at least overseen in a way that it is more effective?
The way it was put to me by this treatment provider was that the courts and the probation officers are overwhelmed. There are so many DUI cases that we don't have a system that really allows for that to fully staff these cases the way we really should.
So we'll be waiting until mm-hmm. the 13th of May at least for lawmakers to reconsider any of these bills that
yes.
have been proposed.
Yes.
And is there some confidence that something is going to be voted in at the legislature?
Well, there's, you know, the biggest question is how much funding they're able to capture to implement any of this. And treatment is expensive and monitoring is expensive. So there are a lot of competing budgets at this point.
So if you were a gambling woman, would you be betting on something passing?
I would bet on something passing. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, you know, how it's going to go, but something will pass, yes.
KOW's Patricia Murphy's been looking into DUI offenses, treatment, mandated regulations, and that series you can find, if you didn't hear it on the air, at our website, kow.org. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Marcy.
This is Weekday.
Minutes past 9 o'clock. Shauna Ahern, the gluten-free girl, joins us in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth between ages 13 and 21 to participate in a study of a smartphone app in a self-directed weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
54 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Expecting sun all day with a high of 72. Sunny tomorrow, Saturday, with a high of 77. More sun on Sunday, possibly getting up into the 80s.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Oncology. UW physicians have extensive surgical knowledge to treat cancer, integrating personalized patient-centered care with advanced surgical options, including robotic-assisted surgery and other minimally invasive procedures. More at uwmedicine.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:14. Jazz great Chick Corea in 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. If you've been listening to Weekday for a while, you have probably heard Vashon Island resident Shauna James Ahern on the show. She and her husband, Danny, are the creators of the blog Gluten Free Girl and the Chef, and they're the authors of several cookbooks. And they've just this week published their latest effort, Gluten Free Girl Every Day. And it says Shauna James Ahern with Danny Ahern, but I know it is both of you together, Shauna, right?
Absolutely. That's just a publishing thing.
Well, this book, of all the publications you've had out, is the one that's for somebody who works every day to come home. You know, not that it's not delicious food, but this is definitely aimed at a different kind of cooking. Whose idea was it? Yours or publishers or what?
A little combination of both. Our publishers wanted us to produce another cookbook, which is just a dream come true.
Sure.
I can't believe I'm talking about my multiple cookbooks. And our editor, Justin Schwartz, who's a wonderful man, said, you know, you need a more everyday cookbook. And then we started thinking about it and realized our first book, Gluten-Free Girl and the Chef, it was a product of our love story. And it's like it was really meant to be showing folks, even if you can't eat gluten, you can have restaurant quality food in your life. And I think that's an important message for people to know. But then we had a child.
And there well, no this more might be restaurant night. Quality, just it a is. Different kind of restaurant.
It is. It's just about getting food on the table. And there's a beautiful urgency to that. And I love the fact Danny does, too. He's no longer cooking in a restaurant. We're doing this full time. And he has never enjoyed cooking as much as he has for our now 4-year-old, because she will tell you immediately, you're a good cooker, Daddy. Thank you. Yeah, good cooker. Although she corrects anyone who says he's a cook. No, he's a chef. So it's pretty funny. You know, there's just something wonderful about making food for your family. And for me, there's nothing more gratifying in some ways, because it, as I say in the book, cooking is the most deeply creative act with the most practical application.
So if you're sort of taking a step back from this, it's organized in a really interesting way. We can talk about that in a second. But was there a defining principle of what you might include in this kind of book, and what you might include something when you're talking about a restaurant quality meal?
Yeah, we wanted to call the book Feeding Lucy, and I wanted it to be how we feed her, which is, you know, we make almost everything from scratch. We're not, you know, going to be zealots about that. Sometimes you need something from the store. But almost everything's from scratch, because we celebrate what's in season. So we're really excited about fava beans right now. And then also we wanted to show her how people eat around the world and not just kind of this typical American diet over and over again. So you'll see a lot of things like Ethiopian chicken stew and dukkah, which is one of my favorite spice blends.
But tell me what that is, because that came up over and over again. I'm like, where is it in here? I don't know what that is. D-U-K-K-A-H.
That's right. Right. North African spice blend. It's got like hazelnuts and sesame seeds and really wonderful, wonderful, deep, warm flavors. And the reason you saw it again and again, one of the things we wanted to do was, if we decided we wanted everything in the book to come from pretty much a grocery store, not the one on Vashon, because it's ridiculously good, so we can't use that as our template. But we wanted to be like, you know, Safeway. And then we added on a few spice blends and sauces that people might have to search for. And then we wanted to make sure they show up in at least 3 recipes in the book, so you get your money's worth if you're going to buy that.
Well, one of the things I noticed a lot, it is, let's talk about the organization. Mm-hmm. It's not organized like here's lunch, here's breakfast, here's dinner. It's sort of genres of the way you would serve food or the way that you might cook it. So there's like one pot meals, there's pasta meals, always important if you have a kid, as any parent knows. Noodles are the basic food group.
Pretty much, yeah. So gluten-free or not doesn't really matter. You know, I'm gluten-free and Danny and Lucy are not, but we have a gluten-free household because it makes it easier and safer for me. She has no idea. She knows it's gluten-free pasta, but she certainly doesn't think it's, you know, substitute. But she would definitely, anytime, what do you want for dinner? Pasta, cheese, you know. So we learned we could put anything into the pasta. She'd eat it.
Well, one thing you mentioned, dukkah, for example, or various spices. This is if you have sort of vegetables, a starch, whatever that might be, and maybe you eat a meat, because some people don't eat meat, but and you've divided it that way. What you've done is create these things that if you add a different sauce on mm-hmm. top, that sort of notches it up a few levels.
Right.
That's kind of the theme. That sort of makes something yeah. every day not quite so much in a rut.
Right. The actual structure for the book came because my brother, who also lives on Vashon, we've been very dear friends, and he is my, he cuts through any of my sort of like lofty ideals. And he said, you know, you're thinking about structuring the book according to ingredients. We're going to have the chicken chapter, the vegetable chapter, the gravy. And he's like, no, no, no. I don't cook that way, and nobody I know does. Maybe you guys do. He said, what I want to do is I can do a healthy meal. I could do protein, starch, and vegetable, but I end up cooking it over and over and over again. So how do I make it interesting? So each chapter is a different strategy for getting dinner on the table. There's the breakfast for dinner chapter, which is probably my favorite. But there's also the big pot of whole grains. So you cook up a big pot of millet, and then you could freeze it in 2-cup measurements in Ziploc bags in the freezer. You come home, you're busy, you've got already cooked grains. You can make a really quick fried rice with scallions and bok choy and bacon and, you know, leftover roast chicken.
We're talking with Shauna James Ahern. She writes the blog with her husband, Danny, Gluten Free Girl and the Chef, which if you've ever looked at it, you have technique now. There's a lot of videos on there that tell me how to do things. But in this book, you've included like how to make the pot of beans. Mm-hmm. And my favorite chapter, which I've marked, is the stir fry chapter. Now, being the old hippie that I am, like revelation here, I have made many stir fries, and I'd say maybe 1% have been satisfying. So can you reveal without selling the book what you really learned that turns that awful hippie mass of sort of moisty vegetables into
soggy.
Something?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking
absolutely.
About.
Well, those were all the stir fries I made for years, too. What I did was there's a wonderful woman named Grace Young who wrote Stir Frying to the Edge of the Sky, and she is the stir fry expert in the United States. The beautiful grace of my life is that I meet all these food people.
Sure.
And so I said to Grace, you know, I really want to be able to bring great stir fry to people who have just been making these soggy messes before. Can you, I've read your book, I love it, I've made many stir fries, but can you help me distill it down into what are the essentials? And so she did. And so did our friend Matthew Amster Burton here in Seattle, who gave us the ideas for stir fry sauces. So one of the keys is just heat, as much heat as possible.
And, you know, in a restaurant kitchen, I think that the stovetop puts out like a zillion times more BTUs than I get out of my, you know, GE range.
Right. Exactly. But, you know, there's a ring you can buy if you really get serious about this. You could put it on the burner and it makes it hotter. We don't have that.
No.
And we have an electric stove. So, it doesn't have to be gas. It's better if it is. But really, when I first met Danny, you know, I would put the skillet on and I'd start cooking right away. And he's like, step back. You know, you have to wait until that skillet or wok is, you know, sort of sizzling hot, smoking hot, and then use peanut oil, which is a really high smoke point, and then you start stir frying.
Well, I think that's the thing that scares me is like, you know, how hot can you heat up metal before it combusts and I have a kitchen fire?
Much, much hotter than you think.
Okay.
I have now gotten over my fear of heat, but you can really wait till, I mean, have everything ready before, so you have everything prepped, and then get ready to stir fry immediately, and then wait until that wok smokes. Really, the first smoke that comes out, you go.
And am I putting the oil in before it's hot? Or
No. Wait until it's hot.
So the pan is smoking. I put in the oil.
And then that starts to
I wait heat. For that to get hot. And then
you, exactly. It's all about the sizzle. So it's really about listening. And that's one of the things I love about cooking is you really have to pay attention to your senses. So you get the wok really hot. You get the oil hot, which will take about 12 seconds. And then you start stir frying. And then there's an order. You want your aromatics first, like your onions, your lemongrass, your garlic. And then you quickly get those and then you set them aside and then you do your protein. Mm-hmm. So whatever it is, with chicken or tofu or salmon. And then you set that aside and you do all your lovely vegetables, add them back in, add in a stir fry sauce.
So the aromatics, do I actually remove those from my wok or pan? I remove everything.
You can remove it. Or if you have a wok with high sides, you can just sort of push it up the side.
Wok versus frying pan.
Oh, get a wok. I mean, a frying pan is, if you have it and you want to make a stir fry tonight after you've bought the book, then sure, go ahead. But, we're so lucky in Seattle. Just go down to Wajamaya.
But I want a flat bottom wok. Mm. I have the wok, you know, I mentioned the hippie days. Mm-hmm. You know, I still have that wok.
Oh, yeah.
You know, wok, the, you know, yeah. round sort of
You can soft. Probably give that one away now.
Use it for a sled.
Grace helped me to understand the one we have is a 14-inch carbon steel walk with a flat bottom. And once you get that, you'll just use it over and over again. And they're about $30, but you'll use it for the rest of your life.
Well, now, the other question I have, since we're talking about pans, I think that's another thing people get confused about. We can talk about baking some other day. And I have talked about gluten-free baking. That involves measurement and scales and things like that. But I worry about... I've got a whole collection of pans. A friend was cleaning out her kitchen. She just gave me a couple more. And I look at them and I think, well, you know, what should I be cooking in? And does it make a difference for these recipes?
Well, you know, I think actually it's funny because we've sort of become fetishized about cooking in this culture. Everything has to be so beautiful and you have to have thousands of pans. We really have four or five pans we use over and over again. And I love cast iron. That's the one I prefer. Danny prefers a really great stainless steel. He has one with a safe Teflon coating for the cooking eggs. But really, we just use the same three or four pans over and over again. So good, heavy, old if you have it, invest a little bit of money, but not very much.
And let us just touch on equipment that you need for baking. Scale.
Yes. You really should buy a kitchen scale. A lot of people are very dedicated to cups and the idea of cups. It seems very homey and nostalgic, and it reminds them of their grandmothers. You can still remember your grandmother without the cups. What happens is... even in traditional baking with gluten, a cup is just not a cup. When you see a cup in a recipe written by a wonderful recipe developer, like someone like Dori Greenspan, what she's done is she's whisked her flour, aerated it, so it's really fluffed up, and then she'll spoon the flour into the cup, and then she'll take the knife and slide it over. I don't know about you, but I never did that. It was just like jam a cup into the bag of flour.
I have to confess, I still mostly do it that way. Bad.
And it's okay. But what happens is I hear a lot of people saying to me, well, I'm not a very good baker. And I just want to say, you're probably putting too much flour in, or you're scared of it, you know. So when you measure, you are precise. And I don't know why precision has become kind of a bad thing. It just means your baked goods are good every time you bake.
But it's an interesting thing because there's the precision of baking, but you also talk throughout this book, you have little boxes that talk about if you want to play.
Mm-hmm.
So there is also an encouragement on your part, maybe not for baking measurements, but to deviate from the Bible that you've put down here.
Oh, yeah. You know, we think of this cookbook is just an offering. It's our, hey, here's how we've cooked. Here's what's working for us. And now go play in your kitchen. It's going to be different. And even the baking, there's plenty of deviation. You know, once you understand how to bake, and the great thing about gluten-free baking is once you figure out your flour mix, which I give you a couple here, it's still just baking. It's still just flour and butter. If you use it, sugar. You can play with different kinds of sweeteners. Every time it'll be a little bit different, and just take notes on what you like best.
So essentially what you're saying is there's templates through
the
book, and within boundaries you can substitute things, you know, this kind of flour. You guys have on your website, you have it in the book, the all-purpose mix, which you then in the next paragraph say, well, yeah, that's that, but I like to do this.
Right. You know, there are a lot of gluten-free books out there that say here is the one flour mix you'll need. I don't think that's really helpful because everyone has a different set of needs. You know, people write to us from around the world, I can't find Teff flour. What am I going to do? I'm going to import it. I'm like, well, just use something else. It's okay. What's important in our all-purpose flour mix is to understand the ratio. I did a lot of work and research and realized that wheat itself, which is the basic flour we tend to use, is 40% protein and 60% starches in the makeup of the wheat. So when we do our all-purpose flour mix, it's 40% whole grain flours and 60% starches or white flours. And it works pretty much like wheat.
I think my biggest revelation, and I'm very slow because I've talked to you so many times, is that buckwheat isn't a wheat flour. Why do they call it buckwheat?
It's actually a derivation of a word from the Russian that sounds like buckwheat, and it's from the rhubarb family. So,
but buckwheat is something, a flour I can use.
You can use it, yep. You have to make sure that it's gluten-free. Bob's Red Mill, whom we love, wouldn't exist without their flours. Their buckwheat flour is made in the gluten factory, and a lot of people are getting sick not realizing that.
So essentially you have to look.
You have to look. What I like to do actually is to get the buckwheat groats, which nobody cooks, so they're cheap. Kasha is the other word for them, too.
Yes, I know Miss Kasha.
You can get them. Kasha's generally toasted, or you can get the raw groats, and then you could just put them in your blender and make a flour, and it's wonderful. It's one of my favorites.
Well, that would assume that I'm going to spend that much time. I actually do cook groats because that is something my grandmother cooked.
They're wonderful.
So now you and Danny are full-time in the kitchen writing food. It's been you know, almost 10 years since you were diagnosed?
8 years this month. Actually, yeah, just past the anniversary, and 8 years this month since I started the site.
So what's the one primary thing that you've learned in that time?
Oh, gosh. Humility. Over and over again. No, you know, we just changed the way that our website looks, and we changed the motto of it.
Yeah, that kind of shocked me.
I know. I imagine it did for a lot of people. It's really beautiful. We're very happy with it. But we also changed the motto, and we just call it Gluten-Free Girl and the Chef, Playing with Our Food. And that's, you know, when I first started, I was a high school English teacher, so I never imagined any of this would happen. And I think I went through a time where I thought, well, I'm going to give people the best and the right and the, you know, that kind of stuff. Eh, I threw out the rules. Now we're just playing.
Everybody's playing. Shauna James Ahern with her husband, Danny Ahern. She has written a new cookbook. It's called Gluten-Free Girl Every Day. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks as always to have me here.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:29. A conversation with jazz musician Chick Corea in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Lottery, supporting the Washington Opportunity Pathways account to help fund higher education scholarships in Washington. More at wahlottery.com.
Okay, let's get this show on the road.
Come see how radio is really made.
Ow!
Radioactive summer session applications are open for youth ages 16 to 18.
Oh, and then this is where I have that awkward silence because I forget that it's my turn to talk.
Apply online at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture, proud supporters of the Seattle Symphony. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
54 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Forecast says it's going to be sunny all day with an afternoon high of 72. We'll get a more detailed scientific weekend weather forecast in about 20 minutes on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
It's not very often that I get to sit down with a living legend, but we're here at Jazz Alley today with somebody who I have, I guess, worshipped is the right word for a long time. It's musical legend, pianist and composer Chick Corea. I first heard Chick Corea's music when he started his band Return to Forever, which I think was 1971 or 1972, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But Chick Corea was playing before that, and Chick Corea still plays music 40 years on down the line and changing and evolving all the time. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me.
Yeah, sure.
Today.
Yes.
I had read that you started piano lessons at the age of four, but when did you decide, okay, this is it, I am going to be a musician?
I don't know. I don't remember the moment because I always just kind of thought that was it, what I was doing.
Your father was a musician, right?
Yes, yes, and I always liked it, and it was what I liked to do as I grew up, so I never had another thought that I would do something else. I did a couple of different jobs, but mainly I always was focused towards wanting to play music and wanting to make music.
Was it classical, jazz, both?
I didn't really become really seriously interested in classical music until later on in high school. My first interest was the fast-moving music of bebop.
I was going to say, you came of age in the bebop era, didn't you?
My dad had a collection of 78 RPM vinyl, and a lot of the Dial label, which I'm reading about now, which had Charlie Parker on it, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, Roy Haynes, and a young Miles Davis, by the way, playing with Charlie Parker, yeah,
right,
when he was
wow.
19, something like that. So I grew up on that music, and that's what I wanted to play. I mean, I was too young at the time to play all those fast notes, but I liked the motion of it, and that was what got me started.
I've read two conflicting things. One was that you sort of were interested in avant-garde jazz as a sort of youth, but I also read that your first job was with Cab Calloway, which I don't think of as avant-garde jazz. So were you sort of, you were eclectic even as a young guy?
Yeah, those are like two isolated moments over really a reality time stream that goes moment by moment over decades. The week I did with Cab Calloway was a filler.
Oh.
He came to town with his show, and he had dancers, and he had a little review, and he was playing the Mayfair, I think it was a hotel,
Boston?
In Boston, yes. And I was of the age where I was starting to do some jobs around, and the musicians knew I could read music and could play. And I think I was 16 at the time, and they called me to do the week there.
Wow. You must have been thrilled.
Yeah, I was pretty excited to be, you know, working at night. out at night with the musicians. I found, or my dad gave me one of his old tuxedos, which was kind of droopy around me. And actually, my biggest memory of the week is not so much on stage with Cab Calloway, but in the lounge, in between sets, I would go and sit and listen to this amazing piano player who really, really inspired me. His name was Herman Chittison. You can find him.
Yeah.
The name is not unknown. And he was kind of like an Art Tatum. He followed that kind of line of piano, solo piano playing. He was gorgeous. I had never heard anyone. So I used to sit beside him and watch him play.
When did you start writing music?
I started writing music in high school when I first started listening to Horace Silver's music. Because Horace Silver's music, after listening to the fast-moving bebop, was a little bit more accessible to me. I could copy the melodies down and copy his piano solos and so forth. And then I started trying my hand at writing tunes.
Somewhere I read that you said that compositionally you were influenced by studying classical music, but you don't write, you do write some things that could be called new classical music now, but earlier in your career you won't. So what was it? I mean, in your mind, was there a division about how you wrote a composition as opposed to just playing?
Yeah, you know, that division between genres of music, classical and jazz and whatever other genres, never existed in my mind, ever, ever. I never had it. So when I addressed the subject of trying to define these terms, it always it's a little unnatural to me. I always just heard music as music coming from different sources and different artists and in different ways. And people would say the classical music was, to me, a little distant because it was written down. It wasn't that real. Whereas the other music I was playing, there were real live people playing it around me, and it was real literary. One thing I regret, though, in growing up in the Boston area, now we're talking about classical music, is that Symphony Hall, the famous great concert hall that hosted so many incredible musicians through the early 1900s, mm-hmm. was 15 minutes from our house. And I never once attended a concert when I was growing up, unfortunately. My dad wasn't interested in orchestral music, and so, you know, I think I went into Symphony Hall for the first time when I was in my 20s with an all-star show with Dizzy Gillespie and Michael Brecker.
Well, must have sounded great in that space, if nothing else.
Yeah.
In 68, you mentioned a young Miles Davis. In 68, you actually started playing, I think it was 68, started playing with Miles Davis.
Yes.
You were replacing Herbie Hancock, is that what it was? Or?
Yes. The band was, the great band with Herbie Hancock and Ron Carter and Wayne Shorter and Tony Williams was beginning to change. Ron had already left the band. Dave Holland was there. And Herbie was the next to leave the band. And so I came in. When I came in, Dave Holland was the bassist. But Tony was still playing the drums.
No, I was thinking about that era. That's the era I came of age. I'm just a little bit younger than you. And that was, you know, in the 50s, there was jazz. And, that, you know, the Hepcats went and saw jazz in the 50s. But, you know, there wasn't really rock and roll. But by the late 60s, early 70s, especially when you formed your first big return to Forever as opposed to the second iteration, those two genres were sort of coming together in the mass minds. We were seeing a convergence of people coming together. And you happened to be the right age and sort of in the place when that was going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I and my friends were interested in a lot of different forms and styles of music, and Miles Davis was one of the visionaries and leaders at the time, and I guess I'm surmising that he had been through so much of the earlier music coming from the bebop era and the 40s and the 50s. He was always looking for change, and I think he was always looking to stay somehow connected to the public. And so during the 2.5 years I was with the band, I saw a really pretty quick metamorphosis between a band that was wearing suits and ties to a band that was wearing bandanas and leather jackets and Miles, huge wristwatchers,
right.
and all the regalia of what looked like a rock and roller.
My memory of that era is that he was as much a popular music icon as Hendrix might have been. There were pools of musicians, and nobody was thinking that guy's over there and this guy's over, and they were mostly guys at that point. Mm. You know, they're here and there, but everybody, there was a synergy, it seemed, that was happening.
There was more so. The music of jazz and improvisation was always a different form. I think the musicians that played only pop and rock and blues also looked to the jazz musicians for a certain kind of musicianship, and then the musicians who were playing jazz always looked to the pop and rock guys for, like, wow, how do they connect with audiences like that, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, was the main synergy. That was what caused the synergies. The jazz musicians wanted to find out how to connect better, and the pop musicians wanted to find out how to play their instruments and improvise.
Improvisation is sort of a key thing I think of when I think of a group of jazz musicians playing together. You started Return to Forever. Did I get the date right? Was it 71? 72?
Around there, 71. There was a transition year where Dave Holland and I had a group called Circle for about a year and a half. And Return to Forever started late 71, I think, yeah.
And so I'm going to read some of these musicians, because Stanley Clark, I think you still, over the years, you never lost contact with
yes.
him. So musicians you played with, Ayerto Moreira and Flora Purim were in that original band.
Mm-hmm.
There were folks that you started with, John McLaughlin, I think, came in and out of there somewhere around then, too. Maybe not exactly right at
well,
the
John
beginning.
Well, John had formed his band, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, before Return to Forever. He was one of the first
wow.
so-called fusion bands.
I hate to use that word, fusion.
That's why I said so-called.
So-called fusion.
Yeah.
But for me, what it was this chance to hear musicians who knew each other. Because back to the improvisation, you guys knew each other. You'd work together. That, for me, was what was different when those bands came on the scene as, you know, a kid who grew up listening to the Beatles, you know, as in the 60s. You know, they knew each other, too. But what we heard on stage took off. You know, it was based on, you know, charts or whatever you guys bring up with you when you perform. And then the knowing each other and trusting each other took it to a space that we weren't used to hearing as, you know, late teenagers.
Yeah, there was a lot of camaraderie for sure, and a lot of trading of ideas and mutual inspiration at that point. There still is, actually. It's just a different methods today.
I wonder, you know, they're bandmates. Somebody used the term collaborators, but when you're on stage with a Stanley Clark or Gary Burton, who I know we've collaborated with, are they friends? Is it a partnership? Or, I mean, how do you classify those relationships?
Don't.
You don't?
I don't, no.
Friends?
I mean, they kind of end up classifying themselves by how we work together. In my life, it always either starts with or develops quickly into a friendship. We like the same things, and we have the same goals in what we want to achieve with music. And then the relationship develops from there.
What are some of those goals?
Well, I don't know. They're the kind of goals that's hard to put into words. They seem to cheapen when you put words onto them. But one of my goals is freedom of the individual and the freedom to express yourself. I think all artists have that as a basic desire. Actually, all people do. It gets submerged in a lot of people, but that's one of the ways I like to live. I like to be able to think freely and play my music freely, but I also like to cause really positive effects on people around me, and so I'm always trying to balance out how to take the music that's my personal taste in mm-hmm. music. And then how to give as much of that as I can and get it across to an audience rather than alienate them with something that I might be interested in, but they certainly wouldn't.
So can I use the word accessibility?
Well, you can. It's a cheapened word. That's why I stay away from it. All of the words that have to do with reaching an audience have been cheapened somehow. You're made to feel that you shouldn't reach an audience, that you're selling out or something, and all of that stuff. So, but in actual fact, to me, life is pretty dull unless it's a social event. Life is a social event to me. You have families, and you have, as an artist, you have audiences and people around you, and I like to affect people positively.
One of the big influences that we hear, and I only started to read about when I knew I was going to talk with you, is a sort of rhythm, Latin melodies come into your work. And I read that I always thought that your family was Latin American, but they're from Spain originally, right? Your dad's family?
No, my mother's mother and father are from Messina, Sicily, and my father's mother and father are from Catanzaro, which is in the Reggio Calabria,
Italian,
south of Italy. They're both Italian.
Well, where did the Latin influences come from?
That's why I made a record called My Spanish Heart.
Right.
I fell in love with Latin music when I was and Spanish culture when I was young. The rhythms and the musical culture just have always, I've always felt at home with them. So I played with a dance band when I was in high school that got me into it. Phil Barbosa, he was a trumpet player. I met a conga player named Bill Fitch, who got me into the New York salsa via Tito Puente and Machito and Eddie Palmieri. And then I met Paco de Lucia some years later that introduced me to flamenco culture. And since then, you know, I've met musicians from South America and the islands.
Yeah, I'm thinking of your tune Spain, which is like probably the most famous of your songs from the 70s, I think, or maybe your first big hit. How is a rhythm structure, an American rhythm structure, different from a Cuban rhythm structure or a Brazilian?
Aside from doom, 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 there is no such thing as an American rhythm.
We don't have one.
I mean, American rhythms are combinations of, if you want to get nerdy about it, they're combinations of rhythms from Europe and Africa and South America and our native Indians and Asia. And America was just a whole bunch of trees and grass for a while, right?
True.
And
totally.
Native Americans had a musical culture which was part Oriental, I believe. But our musical roots and Latin musical roots come via Africa, and then combined with the music of Europe and song music, you have so many different cultures and streams of music which produce different rhythms and different dances, and you know, it's endless.
So for you as an audience member and not a music maker, what really touches your soul when you hear it?
I get easily moved by anything creative. I get moved to tears by some fresh creation, so almost anything.
Well, that's nice for you as an audience member.
It's nice for me. I mean, but as a pianist and composer and professional, like trying to always improve myself, I spend most of my listening time on projects, trying to improve myself or trying to find out something more that interests me about a certain musician or a certain way of music, and I'll get into studying them to break it down to see if I can learn something further. There's something missing in my musical language, and I want to add to it.
One of the things that's really astonishing when you start reading about your history is not only that you've been actively making music for five decades or so, but that you have what seems to be a constant and ever-changing series of projects, bands, if you want to call them that, sometimes simultaneously. And like, they're, you know, I wonder if you ever sleep or do you ever stop, because it's just constant.
They appear simultaneous because I guess there's several of them in a year or something like that. But they're actually quite concentrated and specific. Like, this is the tour that I'm out with my new band, The Vigil. And that's what I'm doing. I'm doing The Vigil. Although I have a couple other projects that I'm preparing for, like in the afternoon, I'm writing some music for three other projects. But when I come to perform at night, it's concentrated on the group.
Well, so what is The Vigil now? What is this latest project?
Oh, it's, I've been wanting to put a new band together to play music that has been kind of stacking up. Like small group music. And I've been doing so many collaborations these past 5-10 years.
Yes.
With Bela Fleck, with Bobby McFerrin. I have more collaborations this year with Stanley Clark, Gary Burton, as you mentioned. That the music that I write for a small group, it was something I wanted to explore more, and I had this idea of combining percussion with the percussionist, which we're now experimenting with. So I developed relationships with these and met some of these young musicians, and we put it together. We made a recording, and we're touring and performing all year.
You were born in 1941, so people can do the math. You're in your early 70s, and you have the energy of somebody 25. Do you anticipate a point where you'll just want to take it a little bit easier?
No, not really. That's a bodily function, not a spiritual one.
The spirit's strong always.
Yeah, I mean, life is, to me, is communication and activity and being with friends and of course for me is playing music. So that's life.
Chick Corea playing live at Jazz Alley. We want to thank Bernie Kirsch, Fausto Torres, and Jazz Alley. Chick Corea and The Vigil will be at Jazz Alley through Sunday.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
Okay, can you guess? That's either the worst or best sound of summer, depending on how you feel about bees. Our listeners, Sukina and Michael, sent us the sound, and you're listening to carnelian bees, which are supposed to be hardier in our winter climate than the other bees that are most widely distributed in the world, the Italian bee. Sounds like a lot of bees. Sukina and Michael didn't say how many bees they keep, but they do. They do keep bees, and some people theorize that bees, what people do when they keep them, helps preserve them in the wild, and they're very excited to be welcoming bees to their home. I like that because it makes me think of summer. What interesting sounds are you listening to? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of the sound that you hear and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email it to us at weekday@kuow.org. Make sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. We'll be excited to use it. Well, since Sukina and Michael were talking about the sound of summer, if I were near a window, I could look outside and think maybe summer really is going to come. Nick Bond, state climatologist, joins us now. And my big question, Nick, is will the sun stick around for the weekend?
Yes, it will. We're pretty confident. It's, well, today
these high clouds that are in the eastern part of the sky will kind of drift past a sunny day, low to mid-70s, a couple of degrees warmer Saturday, and then continued sunshine, and then Sunday, it maybe even will hit 80 degrees.
Okay, I welcome that, Nick, but it seems a little bit odd for the first weekend in May.
Yeah, definitely compared to the last couple of years. Last year, we had one 80-degree day in mid-May and then had to wait till after the 4th of July for the next one. And in 2011, we had to wait until July for our first 80-degree day. So it is about 15 degrees warmer than normal, but not unprecedented.
Okay, so it's not that you know, all the climate change theorists say this is it, everything's wacky because of global warming.
No, it just has to do with the kind of atmospheric circulation patterns in the central U.S. They've been grousing about all the snow and cold weather for this time of year, and so we're just lucking out. And but it is really remarkable compared to the last couple of years how much quicker start we are getting to the nice weather, and that's kind of evidenced by the temperatures of Lake Washington.
Really, is it warmer in the lake?
Yeah, it's running about 4 degrees warmer than it was last year at this time, and that's due to both the air temperatures and the amount of sunshine, and so you know, it shows that we're getting kind of a head start on the nice weather. I should add, though, it is still a rather chilly 55 degrees.
I was going to say 5 degrees warmer than normal doesn't mean that we should all be running in with bikinis.
Right, and the rivers are even colder. For example, Cedar River at Renton is running about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and most of the streams in western Washington are running something like 20% higher than normal for this time of year because of the healthy snowpack, including some recent snow just as recently as Monday, and of course the warm weather to melt that. So it'll be tempting to get on those waters, but of course, you should be mindful about that.
So when we're talking about, you know, into the 80s possibly by Sunday, is the forecast or at least long-range outlook for continued fair skies?
Well, Monday could be actually even warmer. I think right now it's looking like that will be the last really warm day, maybe into the low 80s even. And then some cooling off on Tuesday and into kind of a more typical pattern of morning clouds and afternoon sunshine and temperatures more in the upper 60s, let's say. But right now it looks like the next real chance of any rain is next weekend.
Seriously, 7 days from now?
Yeah, and you know the saying, April showers bring May showers, at least around here.
You
know, that just doesn't seem to be the case this year, at least for the, you know, early part of May.
Huh. Does this pose any problems in terms of snowpack, or are people worrying about that?
No, we're in good shape there. Our snowpack is near, in some places, slightly above normal, and so we're in good shape there. And again, we kind of lucked out this whole winter with relatively few storms, but a healthy snowpack. Other parts of the West, especially California and the Southern Rockies, are hurting. And there's already some fires in Southern California and all that kind of nonsense. And so we should feel pretty lucky here.
So just a last, you know, sort of summer dreaming question. I always worry when we get these kinds of early warm days because, you know, I feel like we have a quota and it's going to be used up. But can I look forward to summer is what I'm dreaming.
Yeah, right now we don't have a great deal of skill, you know, months out ahead of time, but it looks like it should be a pretty nice summer. There's no indication that it's going to be on the crummy side, certainly, and we can't promise, you know, hot, sunny weather every day, but it's looking pretty good.
That should be your next. We were on our Facebook page. We were talking about what superpower skills we'd like to have, and so the one that I'd wish for you, Nick Bond, is to make summer summer.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. If you're just tuning in, Nick says expect sunshine today, temperatures in the low 70s. Tomorrow, temperatures in the mid 70s. Sunday, temperatures in around 80.
And Monday, we burst into flames.
No, I was just thinking, Bernard, that if anybody was thinking about a great weekend to take a long weekend, this might be the one. We're not saying, because you and I are going to be here on Monday.
Oh,
indubitably. Indubitably. Well, we're not going to talk about weather, but we are going to talk about news in the next hour with Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and you. And you can rehear portions of the show if you've missed them at our website, kuow.org. This is 94.9 KUOW.
It's 9:59. In the news this morning, the unemployment rate is at a four-year low. More in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's. Its new cancer, critical, and emergency care expansion, nicknamed Building Hope, provides more beds, advanced technology, and a healing, family-centered environment for children and teens. More at seattlechildrens.org/buildhope.
This is Chinese blogger Huang Qi. He's taking calls from people all over China with complaints about the government. He's been free to post their grievances online, but he's also been jailed for his activism, harassed by authorities, and been forced to move 19 times in the past year. Free speech? Some of the unfinished business in China. Hear it on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 7 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral programs in six different colleges. Accreditation and graduate admission information.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.